Hey, y'all. How's it going? Welcome to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. I sound really happy to be here, don't I? Hey, what's the thing getting here? All right. Well, so I am going to interview Rebecca Gordon today, all about her piece about people who, by their stories, show that, there was no necessity behind the torture program. If there was, how come all these people resisted it? Of course, it was all about lying into war with Iraq. That was the basis of the torture program. Anyway, so it was funny because when the article came out, I thought, this is kind of out of the news cycle now, kind of old news. And then I thought, well, hey, wait a minute. Is that fair? The torture report came out, and then, all right, well, we pretended to care about it for a little while. Now we're just all going to move on again, or, maybe it's important to try to keep it in the news. After all, there are a lot of unprosecuted torturers waiting to be tortured, so, still kind of an evergreen thing, right? Well, Rebecca Gordon thinks so I agree with that. She's going to be on the show. And then I got some invites out, some good ones, and I am anxiously awaiting their return. But I guess we'll see. But other than that, I still got plenty of news to cover anyway. Plenty of bad news. Before the bad news, actually, I'll tell you some good news, which is that you can help antiwar.com continue to exist. So, take all that money that you have and give as much of it as you can to antiwar.com. And then that way, antiwar.com can continue to be a thing. And I'm laid off from there, but I'm kind of sort of half rehired anyway, but only kind of sort of half. But that's fine. But the point is that Jason and Justin and Eric and Margaret, the work that they're doing there at antiwar.com, well, anyway, if you're anything like me, you need them. And so, give them money. You're talking about a bare bones operation. As far as, activist bang for your buck, there's really nothing that compares to it. And I remember, 1999, my friend said, hey, look at this site. It's antiwar.com. And I said, oh, yeah, what's that, some kind of commie thing? And she said, no, check it out. Click, click, click. And then within a couple of clicks, she was at Lincoln, the American Lenin, which was by, good old, what's his name, from Arizona, right? L. Neal Smith. And I don't think it was published at antiwar.com, actually, but maybe Justin had just linked to it or something. Wow, cool, man. So libertarians got the URL, antiwar.com. If that ain't the most coolest, most important thing going on in our society right now. And that was before it got bad. That was only when it was horrible. Anyway, you agree with me, don't you, about that? Raimondo's still my favorite columnist. He pisses me off sometimes, everybody, but still the best columnist that we got going right now. 3 articles a week explaining the what the hell behind all the most important stuff. And Jason Ditz all day, every day, on top of every news source on Earth worth looking at and figuring out what the hell is going on there. So, what more do I have to say? Go to antiwar.com/donate and help support antiwar.com. And in fact, I have my own little fund drive I was going to do this week to try to raise money for to hire that genius to do the YouTube project I told y'all about. But I put that off so that hopefully there's not too much conflict with Eric, which means, hell, I'm going to have to wait a few weeks now. Give everybody a chance to get paid again. But anyway, that's part of how I'm able to do what I'm doing, is I do still make a little bit of money working for them. So, lucky for me, I don't calculate it by the hour, or I could call Barack Obama on them and have have the government make them pay me more, but then I'd just be fired. So, That's how it works. I even heard on NPR, they were like, yeah, let's raise the minimum wage to $20. But, you know, it is true that every time we raise it a bunch, a lot of people lose their jobs. And sometimes these businesses go under. You think, huh? Yeah. Anyway. Sorry, I'm off on my libertarian tangent. The Chapel Hill shooting. You know, Twitter says, oh my God, it's Islamophobia. Jeremy Sapienza, former editor of Antiwar.com, he said, I don't know, man. I looked at the guy's Facebook page. He seems to be, yeah, he's a militant atheist, the shooter, that is. But he seems to hate Christians as much as anybody, and that's not really cause to kill anyone, you know. I don't know. Wait and see here before jumping the gun. And then it came out, well, you know, they were fighting over the parking spot. And so that doesn't necessarily mean that the differences in, you know, headwear or professed beliefs didn't count for something. You know, in an era where it's perfectly acceptable, I guess, to demonize Muslims. But may or may not have had anything to do with it, really. That's the news. But three unarmed Muslims shot in the head, students at Chapel Hill University, by some guy. And then the cops are saying it was the parking spot. I don't know if... I don't know anything more about it. But anyway. On Twitter, everybody's saying, see, terrorism, terrorism. And they do have a good point that if it was a Muslim shot three Jews or three Christians, they would go, oh my God, look, again with the Muslims. Even though the super duper, maybe looper majority of crimes in America are committed by professed Christians or professed, you know, maybe very generally defined, but only because the super duper, pretty sure, maybe not looper, but super duper majority of Americans are Christians, self-professed anyway, whatever that means. So people don't seem to attribute the Christianity and the terrorism to other people killing each other over pointless disputes. And yeah, people kill each other over parking spots sometimes. They do. People are crazy, man. They kill each other. They murder each other all the time. So, anyway. But the point isn't that, oh, well, this is terrorism if that is. This isn't. Doesn't look like it. And then the point is that, yeah, not every time a Muslim does something is that terrorism either. Even if they try to spin it that way. But, you know, it's a larger problem going on with the Islamophobia right now. I was already trying to get, I've attempted to contact both co-authors of the Gallup poll book, Who Speaks for Islam? What a Billion Muslims Really Think, it's called. And I interviewed John Esposito back in 2008. And I just thought, you know, man, there's so much misunderstanding of this. And as I'm constantly complaining, and I'm 100% right, there is a very Israel first, and always has been this way, but there's kind of a brand new renewed effort to say radical Islam, radical Islam. In the day of the massive sectarian Sunni-Shia civil war in the Middle East, they want to say radical Islam and just conflate them all together. Yeah, every Muslim, they're all just waiting to be radical and waiting to be exploded by us for it. And you should not try to differentiate between the Ayatollah and the Caliph, even if they're, you know, deadly sworn enemies, whatever. It's all one big axis of evil, y'all. Let's go get them. And so, you know, that spills over. It does. But if you actually know the facts of the case, as researched by John L. Esposito and Dalia Mogahed in the book Who Speaks for Islam, then you know better, and that'll protect you from the emotional influence there. Fake argument you hear on Fox News all day. Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. All right. Tomorrow on the show, Dr. Paul will be back. Been a little while since I talked to him. So that'll be fun. He's got some new stuff going on for talking about. All right, now I got to talk about Obama's new authorization for war, which is a big deal. But first, I got to finish up what I didn't say yesterday. I made a bunch of assertions because, see, the Washington, the Wall Street Journal ran a thing called, oh, it's so dangerous that people believe that Bush deliberately lied them into war with Iraq. And I was saying, wrong. It was Bush, Cheney, the right-wing nationalists, the military-industrial complex, and the Israel lobby, and their front men, and the neoconservative movement, in the agencies, and of course in the media, especially at places like the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the Weekly Standard, and the National Review, and all the different think tanks, not all of them, but many of the different think tanks in D.C., acting as kind of an echo chamber where everybody knows this and everybody knows that about why we got to go get Saddam. And then the problem was I had gone on too long about cops murdering people and I didn't save myself enough time to mention some footnotes for you. And so, you know, I don't know, maybe you don't know the footnotes. Maybe you already know all these. There's probably some of you who already know all these. But in case you want to go back and revisit the history of how it was they lied us into war, or if you just want to check to see if, you know, I'm right that these things say what I say they say, then you could read Bamford, obviously the book, A Pretext for War, as well as a few different articles for Rolling Stone. Especially, I would recommend The Man Who Sold the War about John Rendon and Ahmed Chalabi. And you can find that at commondreams.com. I know they have a copy of it there. The Man Who Sold the War by James Bamford. And then in his book, A Pretext for War, he does a real great job on all this. The Men from Jinsa, I think, is one of the chapter titles in there. And then you have Julian Borger in The Guardian, The Spies Who Pushed for War. That's a great one. The Lie Factory by Bob Dreyfus and Jason Vest at Mother Jones. Agents of Influence by Bob Dreyfus at The Nation. Karen Kotowski, who was an Air Force, I think, lieutenant colonel, who her boss was right in, plugged into the network. She didn't work directly for him. She worked for him in a different capacity, kind of, but she was right there attached to the neocons. Front row seat, not quite participant. But she saw how it all worked. And there's a few, there's a whole bunch of stuff written by her, but most importantly would be the three-part series at the American Conservative, that begins with In Rumsfeld's Shop, and then, man, I always forget the, I used to at least remember the third one all the time. Anyway, and then she also has one called The New Pentagon Papers. That's at Salon.com. Very important. And, let's see, Agents of Influence, I mentioned that. And I'm trying to think what I'm missing here. Oh, the wife, Larissa Alexandrovna, and Muriel Kane have a thing at Raw Story called The Path of War Timeline. And that thing will just knock your socks off, man. You go through that, and it's links to going all the way back to Governor Bush saying, what you do is you have a war, and then that way you can get reelected and run away with all the Social Security money, or whatever it was. Going all the way back to them, but all of the Project for a New American Century documents, the open letters and rebuilding America's defenses. And I think they go back even to A Clean Break, which was written by the neocons for Benjamin Netanyahu back in 96, about why we need to embark upon this policy of regime change against Hussein in order to get at Iran, not to give the store to Iran, to get at them. That's how smart these evil geniuses are. Not very. And I guess they were right in a sense. The road to Damascus runs through Baghdad, but I'm not sure if they thought exactly like this. Anyway, I'm probably leaving out a bunch of good stuff. Come on, brain. Footnotes about they lied us into war. Oh, man. Oh, Hirsch, selective intelligence and the stovepipe. Both of those are in the New Yorker. They're real good ones. And then, oh, what you do, too, is just go to Google and type in Office of Special Plans, and then that way you can find Jason Leopold, and you can find Jim Loeb, and you'll find probably some Gareth Porter. RightWeb has great write-ups on all of the neocons and their institutions, which means the agencies, especially in the first Bush Jr. term, who all these guys were. And you know, as far as the neocons in the administration, it was Stephen Hadley was the deputy national security advisor. Rice, I guess, is mostly just an empty vessel on this crap. And then you had, in the vice president's office, of course, Scooter Libby was the chief of staff, and David Addington, the lawyer, and there was also John Hanna, and I think Harold Rody was also, in the vice president's office. All of them card-carrying neocons. And then they had John Bolton, who's not a neocon. He's just a right-wing Barry Goldwater nationalist type going way back, but very close to the neocons and might as well be a former communist. And it was him and David Wurmser, who Wilkerson says was actually a literal agent of influence for Israel, not just a neocon, but outright was working for Ariel Sharon, basically. Said that on this show. Colin Powell's right-hand man, Lawrence Wilkerson, said that. And then in the Pentagon, of course, it was Paul Wolfowitz was the Deputy Secretary of Defense. Richard Perle was the head of the Defense Policy Board and was working with Newt Gingrich, another right-winger, but who might as well have been a former commie, as tight as he was with the American Enterprise Institute crowd at that time. And he helped with Libby and Cheney going repeatedly to CIA headquarters to intimidate them into coming up with more lies about Iraq, because the ones they had come up with so far weren't good enough. There's a whole write-up. I forgot who wrote it, but it's really good, and it's at Salon.com, I admit. But they're a lot more cheesy now. They used to actually do good journalism, if you remember back a decade ago or something. And they had a really good piece about Newt Gingrich being very, very, very guilty in working with Cheney and Libby to pressure CIA to lie us into war there as part of that. But then under Paul Wolfowitz, you had Douglas Feith, the Deputy Secretary of Defense for Policy, and then working for him were a whole bunch of neocons, including on contract Michael Ledeen, the madman, but also Michael Rubin and Abram Shulsky and I used to be better at this. Bill Luddy was the guy that was a former officer, kind of turned more ideologue, who was Karen Katowski's boss. Anyway, you can read all this stuff in Bob Dreyfus. And yeah, what it was, oh, in fact, go and look at 60 Minutes interview with Paul O'Neill, where he was the head, I think the CEO of Alcoa, and Bush made him the Secretary of Treasury. And he said he was shocked that the first cabinet meeting was about how to gin up a pretext for a war with Iraq 9 months before 9/11. Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org for all the archives. Here live from noon to 2 Eastern on the Liberty Radio Network on the weekdays. All right, our guest today is Rebecca Gordon. She teaches philosophy at the University of San Francisco, and she's the author of the book Mainstreaming Torture, Ethical Approaches in the Post-9/11 United States. Her website is mainstreamingtorture.org. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Rebecca?
I'm doing just great. Thanks for having me.
Good, good. Very happy to have you back on the show here, and happy to see that you're writing about this. It sort of slipped out of the news. There's so much else going on, important and not, that TV would rather pay attention to, and that's what really counts, I guess. Although, you know, I don't know, with the social media, writing probably means more than it has for a little while again now. I don't know.
I think you might be right about that. It's interesting. Certainly people are not getting their news from the TV as much as they used to.
Right, yeah, that's true. And they're fast forwarding through all the commercials and just watching exactly what they want to watch instead of flipping through a lot too. So that's a big part of that. All right. So, very importantly, you are still on this story. You're pushing back against the mainstreaming of torture and trying to mainstream opposition to torture, which ought to be the default you'd think in this society, but they really have pushed us so far the other way. So, I think it's just important that you're dealing with this issue at all still and continually as you are here. So, oh, and again, everybody, I'm sorry, not again, for the first time. The article is Bush and Cheney Didn't Have to Do It. It's at tomdispatch.com, and we're running it today under Tom's name at antiwar.com as well. Bush and Cheney didn't have to do it. And you're talking about that big excuse,
exactly,
especially that they're invoking now, that, hey, it's the fog war. Even the president, I believe you quote in here, don't you, said, hey, you know, it was a scary time, so it's understandable that they did what they did.
That's exactly right. He says we shouldn't be too sanctimonious because we have to remember just how terrified everybody was. And, of course, this is absolutely no excuse for torture, which is why the people who wrote the UN Convention Against Torture, which the U.S. signed, have in Article 2 this very text. No exceptional circumstances whatsoever, whether a state of war or a threat of war, internal political instability, or any other public emergency, may be invoked as a justification of torture. In other words, I was scared is not a legitimate excuse.
And they weren't even scared. I mean, I guess you could say, you know, poor little Cheney had some PTSD from having to be dragged down to the basement by the big security guards or whatever. I acknowledge that there's probably a little bit of truth in that, but other than that, I mean, give me a break.
Yeah, and honestly, it doesn't matter whether they were or not. They are using that as an excuse. And I think one thing they might have been scared of what it would do to their legitimacy and ability to stay in power if there actually were another attack. It would not have been good. So they might have been scared of that.
Yeah. And I guess, though, from the beginning, they had Addington there nodding and saying, you do not have to be scared of accountability. You are
That's
the
right.
president, and your word is law, and the only part of the Constitution that matters says that you're the commander-in-chief, and that's the end of that.
Right. And, of course, the commander-in-chief had somebody as his right-hand man, his vice president, who could actually command, so, and he was quite happy to take over.
All right. Now, I guess they say that at the beginning, the torture was about, you know, tell us about more attacks, and then it sort of evolved more into tell us about your friendship with Saddam Hussein.
Right, exactly. And it's interesting, even before it was about tell us about more attacks, the very first group of people who were tortured were actually people living inside the United States. There were about 600 Muslims, some of them U.S. citizens, many of them green card holders, some of them here on visas, who were rounded up actually by the FBI and were turned over to police in Brooklyn, New York, and held in jail without access to lawyers or even their friends and families. They were basically held incommunicado, some for as long as 6 months. And while they were there, they were tortured. They were exposed to extreme cold. They were beaten. They were put in stress positions. Some of them were raped, at least one with a police flashlight. And this was all literally within view of the Statue of Liberty. And the reason they were arrested had nothing to do with future attacks. It was because somebody thought they might know something about the attacks, the crime that had already been committed on 9/11. Mm. Of course, it turned out that not one of them had anything to do either with 9/11 or any kind of terrorism. And none of them were ever charged for terrorism. Some of them were deported because they had overstayed visas. But this was the very beginning. It wasn't even about future attacks. It was about using torture as a form of investigation into a crime.
You know, I had completely forgotten about that for at least, I don't know, probably 4 years or something. And I've covered that repeatedly, that subject.
Right.
James Bovard has written at length about it, whatever. But there's so much of this. There's an entire category of the, you're talking about all the guys who were held under the so-called material witness statute,
right,
supposedly.
Right.
An entire category of people rounded up in American abuse that I completely forgot about, Rebecca.
Yep.
Jeez. So, yeah, and if I forgot about it, you know, believe me, it's you and maybe the other Scott Horton are the only ones who've
or
actually got this in mind.
The people it happened to, yes.
Yeah.
I imagine they remember.
Yep. All right, and now, but see, it seems to me, too, that when they're saying, oh, tell us about future attacks, that's actually a smokescreen, too. What they were really doing was saying, give us some fodder for some fake orange alerts so that we can keep everybody scared up until it's time, you know, we have enough equipment in Kuwait to go ahead and go forward with this thing into Iraq. And,
well, I think
and yet
that's
I'm confused
true.
About
they didn't
that
even
because
need the fodder.
I don't know why they needed to get orange alert lies or Saddam Hussein lies by torture. Why not just make them up if you're going to torture him out of somebody and he's obviously lying?
So this is a very interesting thing, and I think it has something to do with the psychology of torture in general, that there is a sense in which they needed to convince themselves of the truth of what they knew was not actually true. And so, in a way, one of the main purposes of torture is not really to get at the truth or to bring it out, but to establish the truth, to make somebody say something that you want to believe is true. And I also think that part of the purpose of torture is to create enemies. And so when we hear that our government, which we think of as a good government, is forced to do such terrible things, that lets us know that the people we're doing it to must be really terrible and that our danger must be really extreme, because otherwise a good government like ours would not be driven to do such things.
Mm. And it's also, yeah, I guess, warning, too, to those who would cross us.
Absolutely.
Could
no,
be.
And that's how institutionalized torture in a country has worked historically. And certainly if you look at the torture regimes of the 20th century in Latin America, in Greece, in the Philippines, all of them worked by creating a climate of fear in the organizations that might otherwise have represented some kind of a threat to the regime. That's the main function of torture in a repressive regime.
Hmm.
In the United
it's terrorism,
States,
in other words. What you're saying, it sounds exactly like what Juan Cole said about the French shooters, that they're trying to sharpen the contradictions between the Muslim population and the rest of France.
Right, exactly. No, it's state terrorism at the level, practiced at the level of the individual. And but the real target isn't just the individual, it's the organizations that individual is part of, mm-hmm. whatever we may think of those organizations. So the U.S. torture in Afghanistan, in Iraq, had this traditional function of attempting, whatever we might think of the groups that were opposing the U.S. occupation in Iraq, and some of them now have turned into Daesh, into the ISIS, whatever we may think of them, the goal, the purpose of the torture was to dismantle those organizations, just as it was in Chile, in Uruguay, in Argentina. But I think also in the U.S., there was this other audience.
Right. All right. Now, I'm sorry. Hold it right there. We'll be right back, y'all, with Rebecca Gordon after this.
Okay.
Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's the Scott Horton Show. Talking with Rebecca Gordon, author of the new piece, Bush and Cheney Didn't Have to Do It. That goes for Obama, too, of course. Obama of the rendition program and the secret Somali prisons. And still Bagram. Does Bagram still hold people to this day, Rebecca? Do you know?
actually, the prisoners at Bagram have finally all been turned over to the Afghan authorities in the last few weeks. So the U.S. supposedly is no longer holding anybody at Bagram. They may still be there, but they're now in the hands of the Afghan government.
Mm. Whether that's an improvement or not is another question. Years they had a kind of separate Penny Lane-style prison there, separate from the rest.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, can you tell us more about that since I brought it up?
Well, okay, so there were actually several prisons in Afghanistan, of course, and Bagram was one of them, and it's an Air Force base, and that's where, in fact, people were held and tortured by the CIA, and some of the stuff that was done there is really horrific. People literally crawling over crushed glass, crawling over barbed wire. I mean, really ugly stuff. And even worse than that was a place called the Salt Pit, which was literally a salt mine outside of Kabul. And again, many people who were rendered in the rendition program spent time at Bagram in the Salt Pit and then went to Guantanamo. And Philippe Sands has done a very good job of documenting that. There are a number of books about this. This is the amazing thing about all of this. This is all hidden in plain sight. It's not as though you have to look very far to find this information, because really good reporters have done a really good job of exposing all of this. And yet somehow it just sort of sinks into this sort of soft morass of news, and it never seems to reach people's attention.
Well, it's because the costs of political accountability would just be too high for anyone else in the state to go along with it, right?
I mean, yeah, I guess that's it.
Put the whole Bush regime in prison. Can you imagine that?
Sooner or later, somebody in a position of power is going to speak up and say, we actually need to have prosecutions. You know, President Obama clearly, for whatever reason, made a decision very early in, the day he took office, that we were going to look forwards, not backwards, and that there was no point in casting blame on people for things that have been done in the past. But in fact, I believe there will be prosecutions eventually. It may not be in the U.S. It may be in some European court, and it may not be this year or next year, but I believe there will eventually be prosecutions, as we're seeing in Argentina today for what was done in the dirty war, as we saw in Chile.
Do you know, what's your best source for the extent of the rendition program in the Obama years? I mean, I know they say, kind of as a cliche, well, no, he just kills everybody with a drone instead of capturing them. But that's not entirely true. And they've said, I mean, there's been some reporting he's got a rendition program, but seems like it's very buried in secrecy.
And the answer to that is, I don't know. I should go and do some research on that. I do not have a good source. Really, the only thing I know about the rendition program is that both Leon Panetta and he said that they were going to continue the program, although they were going to put in extra safeguards to make sure that nobody would ever be rendered to a country where they might actually be tortured, which is what, of course, the convention says you're not allowed to do anyway. So that was nothing new. But in his executive order, that supposedly ended the enhanced interrogation technique, CIA torture, he did not end rendition. And so, extraordinary rendition, by the way, what makes it extraordinary is that we don't have an extradition treaty with the country to which we render people, and also that we are not sending them back for trial in another country, but we are sending them for some other purpose.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, I'd like to give you a chance to talk about some of the people in your article who stood up against this.
It's
instructive in quite a few ways. Do you need to stop and get a drink of water or something? I can ad lib. It's not a problem.
No, I'm fine. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, so first of all, I wanted to ask you about John Kiriakou because, I guess I just don't know exactly what whistle he blew. When I first was introduced to him, he was on TV saying, oh, come on, they only waterboarded three guys, which we know is not true. And, he was a major arrow in the war party's quiver at that time. And yet now, supposedly, oh, he's a whistleblower hero, and I guess he has done his time, a couple of years in prison, although not for the crime I'm mad at him for. But so can you tell me what's so great about Kiriakou anyway, what it was that he did?
Well, I think what he did was, I think he had a change of heart. I think he actually came to recognize what was wrong with waterboarding. And what he did was he actually disclosed to ABC News in 2007 that the CIA had used waterboarding. Now, at the time, what he said about it was, it's torture. I think, you know, he also said, I think it worked. But, of course, I will say that his story has changed a little bit over time. So what he told the Daily Beast in 2014 was, I was at the CIA when the torture program was conceived. I refused to be trained in the techniques, and when I left government, I confirmed that torture was official U.S. policy. So what he did was, without taking a stand on whether it was right or wrong, he actually called it out and was the first CIA official or former CIA official to give it its proper name, not enhanced interrogation techniques, but actually torture. Mm-hmm. And so since at the time the CIA was denying like crazy that they were torturing anybody, this is definitely whistleblowing. It may not be the position that you or I would have taken, but we probably wouldn't have had 14 years in the CIA to begin with. So I think that for somebody who is deeply steeped in that culture, to be able to step back enough to look at something that's happening in front of him and actually identify it as what it really is something that we should give some credit for.
Yeah. Well, and they did put him in prison for a couple of
years,
right?
Yeah, they did. Now, that was for something else. Yeah. Although I suspect that it was really retribution for the torture, for saying that it was torture. What he actually went to jail for was giving the last name of one of his fellow agents to a reporter as somebody who might be a potential source for a story the reporter was working on.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, revenge, much more likely answer there.
Yeah.
All right. And then now I think the other most important after that would be the story of Alberto J. Mora, who, well, go ahead and tell us that one.
So Mora is an interesting figure, and he is not as well known as, say, Antonio Taguba. But what Mora did was he very early on saw these memos that John Yoo and Jay Bybee had concocted whose purpose was to give legal cover to anybody in the CIA who was torturing people. And when he saw these, he became very concerned, and he also heard from the head of NCIS that these abuses were going on already at Guantanamo. So he went to William Haynes, who was the Pentagon's general counsel and was a protege of David Addington, who was then the chief of staff to Cheney. And so on December 20th, he went and talked to William Haynes about this, and William Haynes said, oh, no, that's not torture. But Mora was really upset, and he thought that maybe he had actually gotten through to Haynes and that Haynes would say that either, you know, this was an aberration or it was a mistake and it would stop. But he was wrong. And the torture went on at Guantanamo, and he launched a full-scale memo-writing campaign against the torture regime. And he was in the Navy at the time. He was the general counsel to the Navy. But he couldn't stop it. His intervention also, as he must have known at the time, pretty much screwed up the rest of his career. And he left his post in January 2006, so 4 years later. And he eventually told his story to Jane Meyer of The New Yorker, who, by the way, is another one of the real unsung heroes of this story, who are the reporters who consistently kept after this story, developed their contacts, were able to really get deep into the story.
Oh, man, I remembered that one wrong. I had thought that it was Mora's intervention that finally made Rumsfeld pull back the military end of the torture regime at that point. But I guess
I don't think so. But
it's been too long since I read Philip Sands, I guess. My mistake. But anyway, still an important one to point out, though. So,
yes.
Even though it's not what I thought you were going to say. All right. That's Rebecca Gordon. She's at Tom Dispatch and at antiwar.com today. Bush and Cheney didn't have to do it. Thanks, Rebecca. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Well, I guess the two big wars to complain about would be the Ukraine one and the Iraq one. Let's talk about the Iraq one first. This morning, the president sent a draft of an authorization to use military force to the Congress, along with a letter. And where the hell did my tab go that had the text of the thing? I swear I had it somewhere. Oh, I bet it's down here somewhere. Let's see. Where'd you go? News from the Associated Press. So here's Obama says to the Congress, ISIL will one day be a threat, and they murdered some American civilians who were over there in their war. And so that's his whereas. And then he says, I've asked them to come up with an AUMF consistent with that. I'm submitting a draft of my own that would authorize the continued use of military force to degrade and defeat ISIL, he says, the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant. That's the acronym he likes to use. Not sure why. My administration's draft AUMF, that's authorization to use military force, pseudo declaration of war type thing. It says here, would not authorize long-term, large-scale ground combat operations like those our nation conducted in Iraq and Afghanistan. Local forces, rather than U.S. military forces, should be deployed to conduct such operations. The authorization I propose would provide the flexibility to conduct ground operations, blah, blah, blah. And he's just saying special forces and coordination and white officers, brown enlisted men, and you get it. Kinetic strikes. Missions to enable kinetic strikes, meaning special forces with laser pointers for the bombers. You know, the F-35, its camera doesn't work, so still need a ground guy. Although my proposed AUMF does not address the 2001 AUMF, I remain committed to working with Congress to redo that one, he says. And that could be a real problem as well, because, you know, where he's claiming to narrow it, his proposals in the past have actually had broader language about who the original AUMF applies to. Now, they've always just completely ignored the actual text of what it says and used it as a cover for their wars in Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, not in Libya, not the invasion of Iraq. But and for ongoing, you know, special forces operations and CIA operations all around the world, I'm sure, you know, are all under the cover of the AUMF somehow. The other thing that he does in the AUMF that it doesn't say in the letter is he has a 3-year time limit on it. Oh, yeah, right. It's going to be sunsetted in 3 years. So he's got, I can put ground forces in there, but not that I'm going to use that to actually put ground forces in there, but it needs to be in there. But don't worry, the thing will expire 1 year after I'm not the president anymore, he says. Uh-huh. And then so if Hillary or Jeb Bush is the president, I guess we figure that it'll be even up to the Congress to renew the authorization for the battles already being fought. Give us a break. I want an authorization for the president and the heads of the agencies to figure out who they think their enemies are and whose side they're on. And those who, you know, they do admit from time to time, I guess, some of them, that, yeah, just keep them fighting. But, yeah, I don't know. It seems like they must be kind of freaked out about the rise of the Islamic State the way it happened. The fall of Mosul and all that. They weren't expecting that, that's for sure. Although, I'm pretty sure they were happy to see the Iranians taken down a peg, even in Iraq, not just in Syria, by these Mujahideen. I don't know. I mean, you think Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton and them really said, like, yeah, and then once the Islamic State guys get way too big for their britches, then cool, we have another war against them too. That's what Lockheed wants. Or I wonder about, you know, I'd like to be a fly in the room for some of this stuff. Yeah, it's high treason, and the al-Nusra Front is sworn loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri, but anyway, I bet if we give them some guns, they could use them good. That's the Democrats' foreign policy right there. Let's give the veterans of al-Qaeda in Iraq a bunch of guns. And by the way, I saw Rand Paul on Fox News today saying, you know, the president isn't asking for enough here. He's not doing enough. I would like to see him give a lot more weapons to the Kurds. Why isn't he doing enough to arm the Kurds? He needs to do more. And then he does stop and say, of course, this is all because of Hillary's war in Libya, which they didn't ask him to elaborate on for some reason. And then later he brought up Syria and said, you know, this is partly because of American participation in the Syrian civil war as well. Both very important points. And yet what's his conclusion? We need to do more to fight ISIS now. That in those cases, intervention was just on the wrong side. Which, boy, was it ever on the wrong side. But he accepts that we must intervene. I wonder if the Fox guy asked him, so what are you saying? We should arm Assad too? Assad is fighting ISIS and al-Nusra more than the Kurds, more than the Iraqi Kurds are. You want to arm them? You want to arm Iran? Give them some more, the rest of our old F-14s? Or do they dump all those in the ocean or what? Anyway, yeah, to see Rand Paul complaining like that. And you know, even when he's going to bring up, and it's pretty awesome, and like, you know, it's a very alternative media sort of a thing for a senator to say that, hey, American intervention in Libya and Syria led to this, but it's only partisan politics. I'm glad he's taking that harsh of a stance on the history of what created the Islamic State, because he's damned right about that, and they ought to pay. Hillary and Obama ought to pay bad for what they've done here. And the Republican Party, too. Everybody in the Republican Party except him, basically. But he just wants to score some political points. He's just as happy to see a bunch of people exploded to death. Whatever. It's just some things to say on Fox. It's not... It's just a means toward satisfying his own personal ambition, that's all. And it's sad. Not doing enough. Barack Obama not doing enough in the war, says Rand Paul. All right, and then, I got some more news. I'm going to do some more Ukraine for you here in a little while. But according to this one at antiwar.com, 20,000 foreign fighters are now in Iraq and Syria. Now, I don't know what is the ceiling on how many people are actually willing to go over there and join the Islamic State, especially when it's pretty obvious that the foreigners get used up as suicide bombers first. I guess just yell Allah really loud and it'll drown out your self-preservation in your head. I don't know. Get out there and explode, young man, they say. Still fighting on America's side in Syria against us in Iraq. Now over 20,000. I don't know. Hey, chat room guys, you ever heard a good estimate of how many young Arabs went and traveled to Afghanistan in the 1980s to participate in Ronald Reagan's jihad there? 20,000 sounds like a lot, but I don't know. You know, Prothero and Coburn both are saying, well, and this is how, and they were just calculating on their fingers. They weren't claiming anything special. They were answering a question I'd asked them, not, you know, staking out a claim or whatever. But I said, well, you take the guys who are fighting here, there, and the other places, and it seems to be more than 30,000. Much more, so I don't know. But the bad news is that all, even the Rand Paul opposition to the president's policy here, is in favor of more intervention, not less. So, just wait for the war to get nothing but worse now. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. And so there's this guy, James Antle, who writes for the Daily Caller and for the American Conservative. And he's an unreliable anti-interventionist, non-interventionist. He's pretty good most of the time, but then sometimes he's got some kind of things in there. And, well, I don't know. Not everybody can be as anti as me on everything, I guess. But anyway, he does pretty damn good. And I believe I did put an okay on linking to one on antiwar.com today or tomorrow or something, where he's saying, just let the Islamic State burn itself out. And that's what the West has going for more than anything else when it comes to Al-Qaeda and now their breakoff group, the Islamic State. Is these guys are horrible bastards. They're absolutely ridiculous. And when they tried, you know, after Zarqawi was killed, back in 2006, they declared themselves the Islamic State of Iraq. And yet, half of them or more were foreigners. And they were saying, oh yeah, we're your new bosses, and we're here to change all your ways too. You know, we're all Saudis now, basically. And the locals were like, no, screw you, bang, and shot them and killed them. They were always just the smallest part of the Sunni-based resistance, the insurgency against the American and Iranian project of putting the Badr Corps, the Supreme Islamic Council, and the Dawa Party in power, and the Shiite population in control of all of Baghdad. They were basically the useful idiot suicide bombers for the guys who did mind dying, but were still trying to inflict some casualties. Although really from the Sunni tribal point of view, I think they found out pretty quick that the Al-Qaeda guys were a lot more harm than good, because it was in Al-Qaeda's narrow interest, just like a bureaucrat. It was in their narrow interest to provoke a reaction against the broader Sunni population in order to drive more people into their group, but at the expense of the Sunni population in general, and played, you know, almost an equal role to the Americans on the other side of the war as far as atrocities against civilians and driving the sectarian split. Again, it's all George Bush and Dick Cheney's fault. Zarqawi was no one hiding in Kurdistan before the invasion, so don't anyone get that wrong. But the point is that the local Sunnis got sick of these guys and drove them completely underground, killed a bunch of them, and the ones who were left quit calling themselves the Islamic State anything and basically kind of melted away. And then after the Americans left, I mean, they have been waging comparatively low-scale insurgency against the Iraqi, so-called Iraqi government, the American and Iranian installed one, in Baghdad, you know, the vast majority of that has been a tribal thing all along. And you look at the Anbar province, it was the Anbar tribes who a year ago basically declared complete independence from Baghdad and allowed for a short time the Islamic State to raise their flag up over Fallujah. And then they said, okay, now take it down, because it was they had their own interests, and they were, you know, at that point, I guess, fed up enough to go ahead and declare independence from Maliki themselves. But so in other words, you have the population of Sunnistan. It is a much more divided country since America's half a genocide there or so back in the last decade. And you have them and you have the Islamic State kind of grafted on top, and mostly by foreigners like the Americans and the Saudis and our allies, the Turks and the Qataris. And we're the ones who really built this group up from the nothing that they'd been made into by the local Iraqis. We built them back up again to use them against Assad in Syria. Not we, you know what I mean, the empire. And, goddamn mess. It's a mess, I tells you. And when Obama says, oh no, we're just going to have special forces and spies and air power, and we're going to wage this thing with local proxy forces. Well, what does that mean? He's going to send the Bada Brigade into sack Mosul? That'll work out great. If you got the Bada Brigade and the Kurdish Peshmerga all together, with what's left of the so-called Iraqi army, newly trained and armed, to go sack Mosul, maybe they could drive the Islamic State out of Mosul. But then, so? It's turned back into an insurgency again. And now they just got, you know, the Shia and Kurdish forces fighting far from home, with the Americans only halfway backing them up. So I don't know for sure, but and the Iraqi army has had some wins against the Islamic State. They are basically a militia that's just now trying to be a state. And maybe there are parts of the Iraqi army that are, you know, somewhat professional. You know, if only when they actually went through and sifted through the divisions and found which soldiers actually exist, rather than just draw a salary for their officers in fiction only, you know. Maybe they have a few regiments of capable guys, but doesn't seem likely. Look, and this has been the whole thing all along, and I warned you, it's now 11 years I've had, well, guests on the show anyway explain the Iranian plan, therefore the Bush one, because he didn't know what the fuck he's doing, so hey, yeah, okay, whatever the Iranians say, I guess, is the best policy we got. And their plan was always to leave the Sunnis high and dry. If they can get the Americans to kick all the Sunnis out of the capital city for them, great. But otherwise, you know, they don't believe in the state of Iraq any more than the Islamic State guys do. The Durrán line and the aftermath of World War I. And so what they were saying was, hey, we'll just break off Iraqi Shiistan. I guess if the Sunnis would just be passive and lay there and take it, we can still be Iraq, but we'll call it federalism and give them nothing. And so you see why the tribes would tolerate alliance with the Islamic State for a time. But anyway, I'm kind of all over the place. But my point being that Antle is right, that if America just backs off, it's much more likely, or it's very likely, that the Islamic State guys will wear out their welcome and their ability to continue claiming to be a government in a very short order, just as they've done before. And just like, as Antle says, and just like I've been telling you, if we do intervene on the side of the Shiite militias, on the side of the Kurdish Peshmerga, or anybody else, all we're doing then still is creating a distortion in their power, which is only going to demand some kind of snapback, and maybe our way. And so, the less we do, the better, and doing nothing absolutely best. In fact, doing anything absolutely wrong. The only thing that is right to do is absolutely nothing, except maybe beg forgiveness from the civilians of the region for, and I'm talking about the government, the U.S. government, begging forgiveness for what they've done to these people. And, you know, humanity, for just completely screwing up the beginning of the 21st century like this. They're such bastards. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Hey, all Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, well, I never did hear back from Denis Kucinich. I'm still trying to get him on about the Libya story. Ron will be on tomorrow, though. Dr. Paul, that is. So that'll be cool. All right, now there's Ukraine news, but I'm going to save it till the last segment because I got some other stuff I wanted to get out of the way here real quick, kind of a thing. There was an announcement here. Let me find it on my Twitter feed. Oh, it's, White House. White House weighs adjusting Afghan exit plan to slower withdrawal of troops. Uh-huh. Or no, too slow. That's the verb, too slow, to reduce the speed of the withdrawal of the troops. Yeah, there you go. So, yeah, I told you they're lying. I told you years ago, hey, look, the headline says Obama just signed a deal to stay till 2024. Then he goes on TV and says we'll be out by the end of 2014. Who do you believe, him or him? I mean, the obvious answer is if he's promising something you like, it's a lie. And if he's promising something horrible and evil and more war and killing and explosions, then you can take that to the bank. You've known that about Obama all along. Look at 2007. We gotta expand the war to Pakistan. Oh yeah. You know what? You could go ahead and invest money based on Obama's going to war in Pakistan. No question about that. Oh yeah, we're totally gonna stop torturing people. And sorta. Somewhat. Anyway, yeah, so they're staying. And, in fact, where I got this was a tweet from the great journalist Matthew Akins. And he says, note how the discussion of extending U.S. troops in Afghanistan omits the U.S. contractors. There's 10,000 troops, or at least they're announcing they're extending 10,000 troops, but they have 40,000 contractors there, too. I guess if I wasn't live on the radio, I would have asked him, hey, man, what percentage of those are mercs? And which percentage of those are just doing Klinger's job peeling potatoes and stuff? Or how's that work exactly, you know? But anyway, so yeah, that war's not over. Because if they leave, then the government in Kabul's days are numbered. I don't know how many numbers, but fairly low ones, I guess. And I think there's a risk, although I don't know the real situation, you know, exactly how the different forces measure up, but it just seems on the face of it risky in a Beirut barracks, Khobar Towers kind of way to have a garrison of American soldiers, say 10,000 of them, without another 10 to protect them. Not that I'm advising that, but I'm just saying it seems like kind of putting guys way out there on a limb. With perhaps not enough weaponry or manpower to really defend themselves. On the other hand, you know, they got all the air power in the world. So, a laser pointer and an airplane will get a lot of death done. Especially if you're talking about a defensive type of a thing when your side has air dominance, right? I don't know. Anyway. Point is, Afghan disaster to continue to go on, despite what you may have heard about the end of that war. No, it's just the end of the surge that accomplished nothing. Just as everybody who didn't believe in it before it happened told you it wouldn't. All right. The other thing I want to talk about, oh, I wanted to mention that I forgot one of my favorite footnotes from the How They Lied Us Into War thing, and this goes along with Bamford's piece, The Man Who Sold the War, and that is How Chalabi Conned the Neocons, which is by, I forget the guy's name, but he's a Financial Times writer. It's in Salon.com, but again, this was back a long time ago when you could find things of substance at Salon.com from time to time. And it's called How Chala Become the Neocons. And you'll laugh your ass off reading it. It's actually pretty damn good, man. A million people got killed. Don't get me wrong. I ain't saying that. But it's head-shakingly, just unreelingly unreal. How Chala Become the Neocons. And then, of course, if you just Google up Chalabi Iran, CIA, DIA, you can read, there's a great one in the Seattle Post, Intelligencer, and there's one in the Jewish Daily Forward, and there's one in, what's the third one I'm trying to think of? It may be UPI or something. Anyway, about how Chalabi was actually working for Iran to lure us into war with their archenemy, Saddam Hussein. He was obviously working for himself, but they were happy to help him. You think that the fact that his headquarters was in Tehran might have been a clue? But anyway, I mean, you can hear what he got busted for was apparently Douglas Feith or someone like that informed him that America had broken the Iranians' codes, and he told the Iranians, hey, the Americans have broken all your codes, change them. Whoa, high treason, right? Well, the FBI investigated, but nobody ever got in any trouble for that. But then it came out from there that, yeah, CIA and DIA believe now that the American war in Iraq was an Iranian plot to trick George W. Bush into invading Iraq. And, of course, that's true. I mean, he was shopping for a bill of goods, but they were happy to sell him one. And then it turned out in the end, who was dumber, Bush or the Ayatollah? Who do you think? But anyway, so yeah, that's a fun read too, man. There's some crazy stuff in there. How Chalabi Con the Neocons. That's, by the way, if you're a youngster, he was the head of what was called the Iraqi National Congress, who for some reason just had gotten a hold of all of these exiles who all had stories of chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons production in Iraq that were all completely ridiculous. Tall tales, of course. And then the other thing I want to say is that Greenwald's the spotlight on antiwar.com today, and that's because his article is about, well, it's sort of about the media taking the government's terms for granted and that kind of thing. Oh, the CIA killed 3 suspected Al-Qaeda fighters, huh? Blah, blah, blah. But it turned out it's a 13-year-old boy that they killed. But see, check this out, man. And, you know, technology's really changing and changing fast. Twitter and Facebook have... I hate Facebook, but, and I kind of hate and love Twitter at the same time, but you got to admit that there is an instantaneous quality to journalism going on now that just was not available even from having Al Jazeera, you know, a few years back, where when the U.S. government, I mean, think about this. The U.S. government used a robot to kill some tribal people in the backwoods of nowhere, Yemen. Which might as well be on the far side of the moons of Jupiter or something as far as Americans are concerned. And yet, no, here's the story of this kid. He talked to the Guardian. Talked to the Guardian. That kind of undercuts my technology thing. But anyway, the Guardian went there. They talked to this kid. And he explained that his problem was that the U.S. government with one of their robots had murdered his father and his brother. Innocent men. They were just out farming in the fields and got wasted by some kid playing with his Nintendo back in Nevada sitting in a nice little air-conditioned lazy boy chair. And here's what the little boy that Obama murdered the other day told The Guardian just a few months ago. He said, in their eyes, we don't deserve to live like people in the rest of the world. And we don't have feelings or emotions or cry or feel pain like all the other humans around the world. That was what the 13-year-old kid said after Obama murdered his father, murdered his brother. Hey, how come our lives don't count? That's not fair. So then Obama exploded him to death too. Terrorist. Bet that's what got him on the follow-up list right there. He was probably not collateral damage at all. assuming that he was associating with anyone he supposedly shouldn't be associating with at all, just because they say so. But anyway, and yeah, they talk here about, yeah, their corpses are all completely burnt beyond recognition. Like charcoal. Right? Just like when the Islamic State murders somebody, like they did the other day. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future of Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. Hey, all Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. So, you know, I don't know exactly what to say about Ukraine. They are talking. I just saw a pretty funny picture on Twitter of Merkel, Holland, Putin, and Poroshenko all sitting there together and kind of nobody looking at each other and everybody looking very uncomfortable and I don't know. Are they wheeling and dealing or what? The good news is, as James Corden explained on the show yesterday, when the Brookings Institution, and it was all, you know, Strobe Talbot and all these sort of centrist, you know, old Rockefeller types as far as Kissingerians and their foreign policy, I guess. Mostly you would think of them that way. When they all came together and proposed the arming of Ukraine, a whole bunch of people just like them on the, you know, realist versus neocon versus liberal internationalist spectrum there came right out and said, nope, wrong, including Kissinger Associates. I guess it wasn't Kissinger himself, but he had one of his lackeys put out a thing. A guy wrote an immediate dissent at Brookings, which despite, which I didn't run, I almost ran on antiwar.com, but it had one, fatal error of fact in there that couldn't pass, but otherwise it was a really good denunciation by the guy Brookings saying, I'm sorry, boss, Strobe Talbot, my boss, but you're totally wrong about this, and here's why. And you got basically corrupt motives and a fantasy construction about events, how they got to where they are and what can be expected to happen. And then you have other people who are saying, no, wait a minute, when the consequences of a conflict with Russia, or as high as we all know they could be, we have to step down from crazy land for a minute. You know what I mean? You can screw up in Iraq. It's doable. Who cares if you destroy that entire civilization from now on or whatever? Nobody cares about that. We know they don't have nukes. We know we're not worried about a mushroom cloud at all. That's why we can go and bulldoze them. But geez, messing with Russia. Somebody up there earned their fancy little Harvard degree and went, well, I don't know, man. They do still have the ability to fuse hydrogen atoms together over our houses, right? So there are limits. And the path promoted by the war party is simply a path to conflict that is completely irrational from any other point of view other than seeking conflict. And when they're called out on their plan, what do you mean? You're going to give a bunch of weapons to the Ukrainian government, then hopefully they'll be a little bit more effective when the Russians help the rebels out. And then, so what if Putin escalates? They didn't have an answer to that. The only answer to that is, well, then if he escalates, then I'll be even more of his guys getting killed. And so that'll be even more of what we want. And then, question mark, question mark, question mark, profits. That's it. What? Then the people of Russia are going to rise up and make Putin stop intervening on behalf of the separatists? Pseudo-separatists. Half-ass separatists. in those eastern regions? Who believes that? It's just a recipe for further and further conflict. And meanwhile, it seems like it's all too late anyway, because the military of Ukraine cannot take on the rebels there with or without Russian help. The rebels are, you know, very much a lot of defectors. Former military officers with military equipment themselves. And I'm sure, not because I know, but just because I assume everyone said so and it seems plausible enough and not too controversial that the Russians must be giving them some help, right? Haven't seen too much in the way of that. They certainly haven't invaded with thousands of troops like they've been accused of doing over and over and over again. But the Ukrainian government, their army is in no position, with or without a bunch of new Lockheed products, to take over those regions in eastern Ukraine. And so that's why the French and the Germans are saying, okay, look, enough of this. Come on, let's work this out now. And trying to make it a moot point whether America ought to arm them or not. But, you know, I don't know, man. I guess I have to hope for the best on something like this because, you know what, if Ronald Reagan didn't get us all killed, then probably Obama won't. I don't know. It seems like, again, like the people at Kissinger Associates pushing back, when the consequences are this severe, you gotta trust a little bit that reason will prevail, if only in the end, you know. Obviously, reason couldn't stop the Kagans from their coup in the first place. And the policy's been terribly destructive so far, but, you know, everybody seems to agree what the compromise could and should be, too, which is, more or less, you know, Austria during the Cold War, Finland, neutrality model, where you can have trade with Russia and trade with the EU. Sorry for saying it had to be either or. And no NATO and no Russian troops either could be the deal. And that'd be the end of that. And it's amazing. It's just another study. It's really no different than the Iraq War, really, where the only people who were for the Iraq War were people who were damned liars and people who were damned fools. And everybody who was just being honest about it and looking at it, including a lot of Republicans, you know, before it happened anyway, were saying, this doesn't make any sense. It's going to make the terrorism problem worse. And, you know, I guess you got to lift the sanctions and figure out something. But don't need a war here. What are you doing? And all these excuses that he's built up this massive weapons of mass destruction program just in a few years since the UN was ready to certify that every last bit of it had been dismantled, infrastructure and finished product and all the rest, didn't make any sense. Same kind of thing here. You got liars and you got the damned fools who believe them on one side saying, yeah, this crisis started when the aggressive Russian Ronchevist empire invaded and conquered Crimea. Except none of that is right. It started when America overthrew the government. Really started before that, when America provoked the crisis that led to the protests that they used as cover to overthrow the government back in November 2013. But anyway, they did a coup on February 21st, 22nd of last year. And they used a bunch of Nazis to seize all the government buildings in the capital and drive the elected president out of town. And then a government came to power that included a bunch of Nazis, and the first thing they did was vote to outlaw Russian as any kind of official language in Ukraine. And when the people in the East used their same tactics and just seized and occupied the government buildings in the capitals in the east of the country, in Donetsk and Luhansk, the government in Kiev, at American direction, John Brennan, the CIA director, was there, busted, admitted, was there, advised them to launch an anti-terrorism campaign, he called it, against the people of the East. It was then that the Russians, they didn't even invade Crimea. All they did was leave their barracks. They were already there. They had a contract to keep their Sevastopol naval base. And they held a probably mostly fair plebiscite where they voted to join. The people of Crimea voted to join with Russia. And, you know, in a sense, Crimea is like Ukraine's Puerto Rico or something. It belonged to them, but only in a formal sense as, you know, political and sovereignty wise. It wasn't, you know, as conquered territory from, in our case, in Puerto Rico. But here it was just Khrushchev drunkenly said, well, it's attached to Ukraine and it all belongs to the Soviet Union and the Kremlin anyway. So just for administrative reasons, he decided to make Crimea part of Ukraine politically. So that was the only reason it needed to be retaken, quote unquote. But they already still owned it all along, and they have since the days of the Articles of Confederation in this country, before our Constitution was ever drawn up and ratified. They own Crimea. So I'm not saying that it was right for them to kill the Tatars back in the 1780s. I'm just saying, hey, you know, it's not quite the way they portray it. And I defy anybody to show me an argument that says, yes, it's true. The Americans engineered this thing with billions of dollars, with these interests in mind. They worked with their good friends in the Svoboda Party. There's John McCain shaking hands with the guy from the Svoboda Party. Here's another picture of him with his Hitler salute. Yes, it's true. America did all this. However, now I think we need to arm the Ukrainian army against the thing. And then, nope, can't find that. The only people proposing the arming of the Ukrainians are lying and calling it containing Russian aggression, as though they and their proxy didn't pick this fight. And prove me otherwise.